I'm Russell Carpenter, director of photography on Avatar Fire and Ash, and I'm here on the Cinematography Podcast. I mean, the lovely thing and kind of the nightmare about these things is that everything's fluid up until the time we step on the set, because Jim can make alterations. And so I had to make sure that I had seen the very latest version of the cut. So in case something changed that I needed to prepare for. Part of Titanic, but a lot of avatars just running around and trying, you know, put your thumb in the dike that's about to break.
This is Cinepod, the Cinematography Podcast, a program about the art, craft, and philosophy of the moving image presented by Hot Rod Cameras. Hey, I'm your host, Ben Rock. Today on the show, I interview Russell Carpenter, the cinematographer on both Avatar The Way of Water and Avatar Fire and Ash, in addition to a whole lot of other amazing stuff. Russell and director James Cameron, yes, that James Cameron, had previously collaborated on True Lies and Titanic, two very small independent films that you've probably never heard of, the second of which won him the Academy Award for Best Cinematography. In this episode, you're going to learn the challenges of working with lighting and cameras in both the virtual world and real world simultaneously with the Simulcam, adding camera flaws to the virtual world with lens flares and water drops to make it feel more realistic, how programmable LED systems allowed for more dynamic lighting changes, the precision of motion capture where movements must be timed perfectly for the digital and physical layers to match. After the interview, stick around for our short ends, our pet obsessions of the week. But first, find out what's going on in the world of entertainment in a segment we like to call Close Focus.
All right, Ben, it is time for our Close Focus. What's going on this week?
Well, since our last week and this week, a little thing called the Oscars.
Never heard of them.
Announced all the nominees. And I'm sure that everybody's already looked them up, but I feel like we should talk about, for our purposes, I think we should talk about, obviously, cinematography first and foremost, and then, you know, best picture, best director, because I feel like that all kind of impacts cinematography. No shade intended for, wardrobe design or production design or any of that other stuff. It's just
documentary short subject or anything else. No, we love them.
So let's just start with cinematography. So you got your Dan Lausen for Frankenstein. You got your Darius Kanji for Marty Supreme. You got your Michael Bauman for One Battle After Another. You got your Autumn Gerald Arkapow for Sinners. And you got your Adolfo Veloso for Train Dreams.
Yeah, that's a pretty good group of people there who made a bunch of good looking stuff.
Yeah. Like every year, there's always that moment where I'm like, I would not say who comes off this list, but I would like to say who should be on this list, in my humble opinion, and that's Alice Brooks for Wicked, who was not nominated for either Wicked. And I think Wicked is a pretty significant achievement in filmmaking overall.
You know, I got to give a shout out for Amy Vincent as well, because I thought Song Sung Blue looked amazing, and it needed more love at the noms.
Yeah, and both of them were shortlisted. I was a little shocked that 2 years in a row that Alice kind of got looked over. But that being said, I do think these are all fine films. I'd also like to say that so far we've had, three of these DPs on here?
Yeah, three so far, and there might be a fourth one coming up soon.
Yeah. It should also be said that the Oscars are noteworthy in that Sinners broke the record for the most nominations ever, beating even Titanic.
That's incredible.
I unironically love Sinners. I think it's a brilliant film. It is a horror movie. It's, sometimes us in the genre space really, really do make the Oscars go. Like, think about, and I'm not saying us like I'm one of them, but, think about Silence of the Lambs, was a big Oscar sweeping movie. And anyone who tells me that's not a horror movie, well, I've got an argument for you. Anyway, let's talk about directing. We've got Chloe Zhao for Hamnet, Josh Safdie for Marty Supreme, Paul Thomas Anderson for One Battle After Another, Joachim Trier for Sentimental Value, and Ryan Coogler for Sinners again.
Yeah, it's directing this year. Is there a front runner you would say right now? Is Paul Thomas Anderson the one to beat?
For directing?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny to hear the
I don't understand the politics of the Oscars. So I don't know if the actual winners have already been chosen and they're just sitting on them until the ceremony, or if there's further voting within the Academy leading up to the ceremony. But it was kind of a surprise to everybody because it seemed that one battle after another was the obvious front runner until the nominations came out. And then Sinners, I think, kind of pulled into the front, you know. And when I kind of think politically, and we'll eventually have our old friend Janelle Riley on the show to kind of talk through this stuff. It's like, it is Paul Thomas Anderson's time to win an Oscar. And One Battle After Another is a great film. So it's not surprising that it's getting all the love that it's getting. That being said, you know, Ryan Coogler's not exactly new at this. He's been doing it for a while. He's been doing it at a very high level. And Sinners kind of showed that in a piece of original IP that was, you know, just kind of a genre-leaning film. In fact, a few genres. It's not just a horror movie. It's also a musical. You got your river dancing vampires in there. Could really captivate an audience. And I was actually really pleased because I remember after I saw the movie, I probably said this to you. I've been saying it nonstop. Delroy Lindo is so overdue for an Oscar and his performance was so good. So I was really, really happy to see Delroy Lindo get nominated. I'm happy for everybody who gets nominated and I'm not like choosing favorites, but I felt like Delroy Lindo is someone who's just been doing amazing work for, I don't know, 40 years or so. It's about time he got recognized for that on some level.
And he turns in so many good performances in so many great movies. I remember him in Get Shorty being blown away by him. Like, you know, I'm really happy to see him nominated.
Yeah, he's just phenomenal. I think one of my favorite performances of his is in a David Mamet movie called Heist that stars Gene Hackman from, I don't know, it's like 2000 or something. Anyway, real quick, let's go through the Best Picture nominees. Begonia, F1, Frankenstein, Hamnet, Marty Supreme, One Battle After Another, The Secret Agent, Sentimental Value, Sinners, and Train Dreams. So I'd say runs the gambit. To me, the outlier on this list is F1. And I liked F1. It's a fun movie. Best Picture?
Yeah, I it was a little bit of a head scratcher to me. It's a fun movie. It's a good movie, but It doesn't exactly feel like it's like all the others. It's like one of these things does not match the others. Yeah.
Seriously, I understand why every film is on this list, except I mean, like, I could see F1 getting nominated for things like editing and visual effects and sound design and sound mixing and production design, even. Like there's a lot of places where it makes sense, but it's I'll just say it. It's I don't feel like it's meant to be a weighty dramatic experience. It's supposed to be kind of a fun popcorn chomping fun movie. Now, here's the thing. To me, there are several movies on here that are outrageously entertaining, like Frankenstein, like Begonia, like Marty Supreme, One Battle After Another, and obviously Sinners, that don't feel like they are, they don't feel weighty. They are, you're excited after you see them. Like they are entertaining, they're entertainment, but also there's just so much more to them. And to me, that's sort of the sweet spot that you want to hit with a Best Picture nominee. I sort of wonder if Apple threw a lot of money at a campaign to get the nomination for F1. Cause also I feel like do the thought experiment. F1 wins Best Picture. Does it change? Does it make anyone new see it? Like everyone who wanted to see a car racing movie has already seen F1, and God bless them. I liked it. It's a fun movie. It's just kind of a head scratcher to me. I'm not zero shade at anyone who made F1.
Not at all. No, it is a good, solid movie. It also doesn't feel like the type of movie that the Academy usually, you know, bestows a Best Picture to.
It's what it is all the other movies on this list are complex in some way. And F1 is just right down the line, straightforward, exactly what you think it is. And the best possible version of that. Nothing wrong with that.
Of the best pictures there, are you secretly rooting for someone? You hoping for a horror win in the best picture category?
Yeah, I mean, I would be lying to say that I'm not leaning probably heavily towards Sinners in all the categories that it's nominated in. I think Autumn did such a great job shooting it. But you know, I mean, like if Michael Bauman won for One Battle After Another, I'd say I'm kind of split down the middle on those two. I love them, and I also love Frankenstein though. You know, it's like
I was going to say Frankenstein, there's two horror movies in the best picture category. So it's like,
And they're like two uncompromising horror movies that like really, really go for it. I was also happy to see that Weapons even got a couple of nominations.
I was too. And actually, I got to say that I'd be totally happy with either Frankenstein or Sinners winning that best picture. I don't feel like either were slouches. They're both great movies.
No, I mean, I think it was actually a pretty good year, especially considering that the movies that came out in 2025 are the movies that would have been greenlit during the strikes. So the studios are kind of spreading the inventory out a little bit, as it were. And these are movies that were able to get made around, you know, probably after the strikes. And so, you know, we had theatrically just fewer titles to choose from last year, out of which I feel like we actually had a really, really great selection of movies. I mean, there's nothing on this list that I'm like, crap, you know, and sometimes I'm not going to say what, but sometimes when you see the list, you're like, really, how did that get on the list? I mean, I guess F1 is a little bit of a head scratcher to me just because it doesn't seem like a movie with Oscar ambitions. It's not that kind of movie. You know, Hamnet, you're like, all day long, that's the kind of movie that wins Oscars. You know, as a genre person, I don't know. I'm excited to see. I don't know. I hope that it's one of those. It always makes me happy if a genre film wins. But I also think One Battle After Another could be considered a genre film as well.
I agree. I agree. All right. So Ben, who's on the show today?
Oh, today's amazing. Russell Carpenter. R Russell Carpenter. With Avatar: Fire and Ash, which. You know, the process of making these Avatar movies is just bonkers, in my opinion, and that James Cameron has sort of exploded every little minuscule aspect of filmmaking and then reassembles it on the other end. And you know, having somebody like of Russell's caliber come in to do not just the live action stuff, but also to kind of light and oversee the overall look of the digital world that Cameron creates. I don't know, it's a big job, and I think, you know, as far as cinematography goes, this is me talking, not Russell. It just seems weird. Like, it just seems like a crazy job because you have so many disparate elements that you have to wrangle. And like, he's used to being there on the set with actors. He talks a little bit about this. He's used to being there on the set with the actors and figuring stuff out. And here he's coming in after most of the actors have completely finished all their work, except for like the kid who plays Spider and, you know, Giovanni Ribisi, any of the live action people. So.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to hearing your interview because this is all hot off the presses. I'm looking forward to getting into it. I still haven't seen the movie yet, so I gotta see it too.
I mean, the visuals of this movie are just unbelievable. Like what they've done with VFX, it's brilliant to see. Like the stuff they're doing in this is going to ripple through, and we're going to see it in every kind of movie in the same way that like earlier James Cameron movies like Terminator 2, you know, the effects that he pioneered or that he forced people to pioneer back then now are just, you know, in After Effects, and everyone who makes a film is going to use them left and right. I feel like that's part of what's going on with Avatar. Like we're going to see aspects of performance capture that we don't even understand right now finding their way into regular old movies and lower budget movies because the way the technology moves. I mean, you can go back to the original Avatar. And then and see how advanced that idea was, and now jump forward to today when you can use metahumans in Unreal Engine and like basically for free with your cell phone, you can do not you're not going to get Avatar, even Avatar 1 level results, but how long before you can, you know? I mean, it's crazy how fast that stuff is moving, and it just allows people to tell stories they never would have been able to tell before, which is what Avatar is great for.
Well, no doubt that the march of progress of technology is happening, and it, you know, James Cameron just continues to raise the bar to work at this highest level.
Yeah.
Why don't we get to the interview now with Russell Carpenter?
Well, let's do it.
You know, Avatar: Fire and Ash, you know, is 3 hour and 17 minutes. It's it is epic. It goes through a lot. And the biggest question that I had for you while I was watching it was, you know, I know that, or I'm led to believe that y'all shot The Way of Water and Fire and Ash kind of together. Did you shoot all of them together?
Yeah. Yes.
So like what lessons were you able, because you still had 2 years later, 3 years more to finish Fire and Ash, what were the lessons that you were able to learn from The Way of Water where, you know, James Cameron had again kind of reinvented this insane technology that he's created to make these movies. What were you able to do in Fire and Ash that built upon what you did in The Way of Water?
Well, even though it was 2.5 going on 3 years involvement, I was on for just a portion of what it took to make that film. I mean, it was like these things are I think they've been working for 6 years before I even got in there, because of the films are made in layers.
Yeah.
From the script, the production designers are tasked with coming up with locations for the script that are described in the script. Those renderings go back to the writers. They look at those. There's a gestation back and forth there. As they get approved, then they start to get built into a CGI world. And then Jim scouts the locations virtually, and he looks around and he says, "But this is working. This is that thing over there is that's not working, and I don't need that there. Just that feature, make that bigger." Okay, so now years have gone by. It takes a long time. Let's just say that.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he brings in his troop of people, and the basic blocking is worked out, and then he even starts to shoot versions of the scene, very rushed versions to see if he likes the, and those get edited, and he sees if he likes that. Here's another, I mean, I don't know, 8 months or so, and then finally they get to the portion where, okay, now we're really doing the film that here come our actors, and we're going to capture these performances. And we kind of know where everybody has to be. You know, Jim says, now they can, our actors can just concentrate on acting. That takes a while, too. And then I come into it, and Jim said, okay, of course, you're tasked when we get to live action, you're tasked with, and your team is making the introduction of human beings into this world as seamless and as perfect as we can make it. And that's, so you know what that's about.
Yeah.
But then he gave me scenes to light too. And so now I was learning to ride the bicycle in the virtual world of lighting and kind of figuring out, oh, what's really wonderful about this and what might really suck about having to, you know, do this way. I lit for over a year. The first scene I lit was from Way of Water, and it's the scene where Jake and Kiri they're on a dock and they're dangling their feet in the water and they're having this heart-to-heart talk, and but it's just beautiful what's coming up from below. I'm doing that, and I'm just learning to function in two worlds, keep lighting as much as I can in the CGI world. And then trying to translate what Jim is doing on the capture stage. And this is after he's had the actors, after the performances, he's now starting to shoot the scenes in a much more way that's gravitating to exactly where he wants his cameras and his final edit. And so, while he's doing that, then my team and I are trying to take what he's doing, what he's coming up with, what the final scene looks like. And now we have to translate that into the math of what we have to be doing in the real, when we get to Wellington, where the big stages are. And some of it is, some of it's just as mundane as did the camera just go through the back wall of the stage? Well, we can't really have that. What do we do? But really finessing things. Now we're in this world of say for motion capture, where things have to match absolutely, I mean, to the half second. And no, okay, the camera starts here, it has to travel this far, this fast, stop here, our actor has to be exactly here, and that's painstaking, you know, and that just takes a long time. So we're taking that and we're saying, okay, well, this Steadicam looks like the best thing here. Or and I know the Jim's gonna for this, we know that Jim's gonna hand hold the camera because he operates himself. This scene, it's not a Steadicam, it's actually a because the stages are this big, it's like a camera car with a boom on it, you know, that's going to do this. This is a huge crane, and so we're boiling all that down, and then I'm working, say, with the production designers, especially in the bridgehead scenes or on the sea dragon scenes, is saying, okay, here are sources here. What do we do to emulate these sources? So this person or even this Navi hits this light at exactly the right time, and the shadow characteristic is exactly right. Or here's light coming up through water, hitting something. And so how do we emulate, you know, on a dry stage, how do we emulate the look of water? What kind of instruments do we use? And that just goes on forever. It just goes on and on and on and on until we finally get, and we're still doing that by the time we get to Wellington to do our shooting. But in terms of, you know, in terms of the look, because basically I come on and Way of Water and Fire and Ash, they still live in the world of Pandora. So somewhat from the first picture, that look has been set. But then in talking with the production designers, and especially as I started to do computer work, I get a sense of just aesthetically where things are going, and you know, and how the light should feel, and some of that was, I mean, laid in by the production designer because you have to light something. But and then some of it, then there are things that I bring into it, and I say, well, for this thing, I'd like this person to come in some light here. I'd like this shadow here. I want this tree shadow here. It's got to happen just this way. And those are the things I do. But in terms of shooting, and in terms of what was done in the virtual world, was trying to shoot as though you were shooting on a film camera. And so, and certain artifacts were introduced into Fire and Ash that we didn't quite have going on in Way of Water, which are, you know, lens flares. Somebody comes up, breaks the from below the water and breaks the surface of the water. I don't know if you noticed, but it was a, they actually had the feeling of like water running off the front plate of glass of a, you know, an underwater camera. They had that little mistakes. I mean, not mistakes, but, you know, catching lens flares.
Imperfections.
Yeah, what you call imperfections that people are used to, that people are, that they know that they see when they're watching a, you know, a live action film. So there was a little of that. And then, of course, because the technology allows you to either say, hey, the CGI world is driving what the live action camera is doing, or Jim's doing handheld, or we're on the Steadicam. And once the cameras are in the morning or before you see, we kind of like lock the cameras in, our live camera and our virtual camera are locked together. Jim's reframing or moving the camera. And now the background, the CGI world is following what Jim's camera is doing. So this door swings both ways in terms of what's driving what.
Wait, so like literal physical things are moving on set in accordance with?
Well, physical things, I mean, let's just say this. Yeah, so let's take the most basic thing. You have a scene where you're shooting over Spider's shoulder and he's interacting with Quaritch or something. And so it's just basically an over the shoulder shot. And yet you can go, oh, well, maybe it's more interesting if we came back a little bit, walked this way a little bit, maybe we move Spider around. He doesn't have to be in the same position he was when the scene was conceived. Now the CGI character can be moved or resized or something, but it's not that easy. So, but however, I'm just saying, as we move the camera, the background, whether it's a forest or it's the environment at Bridgehead, will do exactly the things they're supposed to do if you move the camera. If you were jarring, the camera was, you know, bumping a little bit, mm-hmm. that CGI background would do that instantaneously. And because of the technology called Simulcam, we could get instant feedback as to what was happening. And of course, that helped me with my lighting so much, because I could instantly see when somebody was supposed to come into the lighting that was in the... you know, if they're running through a forest or something and they're stopping and the lighting's, you know, hitting the actor halfway up his body, I can make sure that my real lighting is hitting the real actor in exactly the same fashion.
That is like, that kind of just bends my mind to think about the complexity of doing that.
Yeah, you know, it's like, and it's like I try to tell people who I say, you know, this is really challenging, but I think, you know, but still, it doesn't have the joy of being on a set with real actors in a real environment with your crew around you and all that. I think that has a certain energy and a certain beauty to it. You know, especially feeling like, gosh, we got this tremendous scene. The actor was so good, and doesn't have that flexibility. And the kind of the emotional payoff at the end of the day is not the same as if you were shooting an entire scene and you finished it in the day or something like that. This is just like for us. it's not that it was the high mark, but it was like, well, we didn't screw that one up. This looks well. Our job looks like we did our job really well, which is, you know, to especially have the invisibility that you need to have to make it look like the, you know. And there's some interesting stuff, you know, when in Fire and Ash, the sun. I mean, where Jake takes Spider into the forest and he's going to kill him, you know.
Yeah.
At the end of the scene, I mean, your CGI character literally embraces Spider and pulls him to him. You know, that's not like two aspects of the movie 5 feet from each other. So I think that was something. That's where the, and this is really more over on Weta's side. That's where the technology, because we're getting way back to what you asked. That's where the technology has changed. The technology changed in that performance capture was even of actors' faces was even more nuanced. I mean, you just in terms of when we watch a human face, there's stuff going on in the muscle structure under a person's skin that I think they really nailed more, like these micro clues, you know, about what somebody's, I think they really moved that along. And I think maybe a little, I mean, it's really almost unconscious. It was, you know, just achievements that what it made and almost the unconscious representation.
I mean, the crazy thing is like watching the movie, like not for one second does my brain register these things as CGI. They all feel so, they feel like you could touch them. They feel so unbelievably real, and every nuance of the performance being kind of transferred into this CGI character is just insane. But, you know, from a lighting and lensing point of view, like one of the things I kept wondering about was, I assume that in the virtual world, you are basically saying, well, let's throw a 50 millimeter lens on, let's throw an 85 on or whatever. And I was curious, and I don't know if there's really an answer to this. This is maybe me digging in too much, but it's like, was there a specific kind of lens you were trying to emulate? Were you going more for a Zeiss look or a Cook look or, you know, Panavision or whatever? Like, what are your digital lenses?
Well, here's the can of worms there.
Okay.
Basically, when we were handheld or on the Steadicam, we used basically two. I mean, well, when I say two, that probably means four lenses, because you have to have a double, you know, you're shooting with two cameras. And what drove pretty much everything was the technology, because Jim needed, even though we were going with a much a bigger target area than was used on the first Avatar, which meant that that drives kind of the sizes of the lenses up and stuff like that. And Jim wanted the rigs to be lighter than the first one. And so there was a lot of stuff going on over the period between Avatar 1 and Avatar Way of Water. But when I came in, we had to settle on some lenses, and we tested it. The idea was, can we find light enough lenses that, especially zoom lenses, because Jim, he'll definitely change his focal length. You know, his focal length doesn't have to be what it was when he was shooting with his virtual camera, because again, the background will emulate what his camera, what the decisions he's making with the live camera. So we needed light enough lenses that would give us the optical quality. And we found Fujinon had made prosumer lenses. The MK series, they're 8 inches long. They're 2.2 pounds, very light, very small. They can fit inside, you know, the 3D rig. And the lenses track perfectly with each other because they're computer made. And they were as sharp as the top end of the line Fuji Promistas. And I was just knocked out by that. So that did solve the problem. Mostly, I don't know, in terms of live action, it was rare that Jim would go longer than like a 35 or 40.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And the reason is, the longer you go out on your lens, the less feeling of depth that you get.
Oh, I guess that makes sense, especially in 3D and stuff.
Yeah. So we basically worked off one lens, which was like an 18 to 55. And we would just stick with that lens, and unless there was some reason to go to a prime to get wider or something like that. It was surprising that we didn't change lenses that much. But it was a really great find to find these prosumer lenses that technically were knockouts, you know. So that was great.
But like inside, like for the virtual lensing and you know, for the stuff that's like purely all performance capture and you're lighting virtual scenes, were there any things that you would do lens wise to emulate, you know, I don't know, chromatic aberration or vignetting or any of the things lenses do? Or because it's 3D, are we just trying to make it as pristine as possible?
Oh, and then in that point, yeah, because it's all in the virtual world, yeah, you could do that. But I don't think, you know, we talked about aberrations and introducing those
flares, you know.
Flares, yeah. And that was, we tested shooting flares live, either flares that happen because of lights. We tested what happens when light bounces off a metallic surface, a ProMist or some sort of other diffusion lens. And then when Joe Letteri at Weta saw these tests, he said, if we introduce this during either our live action cinematography or, in virtual, it's another case, you're kind of nailed into that. Let me do some testing and I'll send you back something that shows whether we can emulate these things or not. Mm-hmm. And his tests were great. And that allowed, okay, we can really pick and choose when we want our lens flares and this flare or that, or otherwise. Jim is very, very conservative with 3D. He's in the sense that he says, all I want this to do is function in a way that the viewer and the viewer's brain get immersed in this experience that they have. I don't want to do crazy stuff or shock stuff with the lens. So the convergence of the 3D lenses was always, usually, I would say 99% of the time, set on the eyes of the actor that you were looking at. So it operated in a completely...
And when you're talking about convergence, that's when you're saying, correct me if I'm wrong, I just want to make sure I understand it and our listeners understand, but it's like within 3D space, they're resolving kind of like at the film plane.
Basically at the film plane, basically not making it look like something is way further back than it should be, or not making it look like something is floated off the screen and out into the audience. You know, he said, that's not my deal. Leave that to somebody else. You know,
yeah.
You saw that a lot when 3D was just starting. They were doing things for kind of shock or novelty effect.
Well, yeah, it's the parlor trick of it. You know, I always remember going to Epcot Center when I was a kid and seeing, you know, the Magical Journey or Captain EO or something where they're like shoving stuff in your face all the time. And, you know, it's, and these aren't doing that. These movies all kind of are just kind of immersing you in this world. So, you know, I don't know very much about 3D, but I know that you've got the convergence thing, which is like that, again, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's like putting where in 3D space, where
an object is in 3D space and how wide the pupils are from each other. And
yeah, that's interocular distance, right? Where it's like
interocular distance. Yes. Yeah. So
don't ask me why I know this stuff. I've never once shot 3D in my entire life.
You know, I'm realizing, oh my God, it's almost been 6 years since we finished the live action part of that.
You shot all the live action for both of them 6 years ago?
Yes.
Oh my God. So like what happens if we do part four and the guy playing Spider has to come back, you know, like he's going to look.
This is baked in because in four, he could be in his 20s, which might be where Jack Champion is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because there are between each film, or at least between three and four, there's a several year gap.
Yeah, yeah.
So Jack's character is, you know, Jim is somewhat future proofed.
Oh, that makes sense.
Thing, but you'll notice in the films. I mean, if you were really watching for it, because it was freaking us, you know, out because the film got delayed, and then there was COVID, and it got delayed some more.
Strikes.
The actor who played Jack was growing up. I mean, before our eyes, you know, so you'll notice some, you know, if you're looking from in this scene, he definitely has a different form to his face than he does in this scene.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah. I mean, it's, yeah. I would say to any cinematographer who kind of ventures into this territory, there's a learning curve where you definitely feel like a stranger in a strange land.
Yeah.
In terms of realizing that the ecosystem of information and moving parts and how many different departments are involved in a shot is just something you just have to get used to, and you realize that especially in terms of live action, your percentage of the pie is yeah. less. I mean, it's just as important, but it's less than you would, you know, if you were doing a Sundance film for, you know.
Well, yeah. I mean, well, based on what you told me about The Way of Water, you know, it's, and I was describing this to somebody the other day, it's like you took the entire process of making a film and exploded every part of it into a million little pieces and then worked on the pieces. So, you know, like ordinarily you would line up the shots with the actors and then they would act and that would be it. But now you're separating the performance from the appearance. And like, you know, so you're not there for the performance on a lot of the stuff, if I'm not mistaken, but you're there to make it look like it fits in that world. And then
the only performance that I actually witness is with our, of course, with Spider, but with any of the other players, Edie Falco's character or Giovanni's character, yeah. or, you know, and that's.
By the way, did you know that Giovanni Ribisi is DPing now?
Yeah, no, I knew because my gaffer on Way of Water is a good friend of Giovanni's, and he was telling me, Giovanni is way into this, and he's always loved doing this.
He's great.
Yeah, my gaffer, let me say, he's really, he's totally devoted to it. He's really great. You should, yeah.
No, I think Strange Darling looks amazing. Anyway. Back to your thing, though. So, like, all the live action you shot was 6 years ago. Did you shoot it on the Sony Venice that you shot it on?
Yeah, yeah. The test, I did a test that I shot on the Arri Alexa before I actually got the gig to do Avatar. That did go well. They built a forest on stage, and Jim just said, can you, with a live action camera, can you make this forest look like the world of Avatar? And we know we weren't going to get all the amazing plants, but that went really well. And in fact, I was surprised. He went back to his computer people and said, see this test? Look at this thing. I really like this about what they did in the test. And so in some weird way, that influenced something or another films. But I don't know exactly what, but here's the timeline of this. So I did the test in 2017. Then in 2018, I start doing the lighting and preparing for the things that we're going to do in 2019 and 2020. And so that's my timeline.
How do you keep it all in your head? How do you keep all of your thoughts organized? Because this is not a small thing. You're making two movies at once, and they're both like 3 hours long. It's so much.
I mean, the lovely thing and kind of the nightmare about these things is that everything's fluid up until the time we step on the set. Because Jim can make alterations. He can go into, he had a little motion capture stage in Wellington. And he could go in and he can make alterations for performance or something. And so I had to make sure that I had seen the very latest version of the cut. So in case something changed that I needed to prepare for. But my team and I were always looking at what was coming out and say, okay, this is done. And we would go and we would make our notes and we would have, I mean, you know, part of Titanic, but a lot of avatars just running around and trying, you know, put your thumb in the dike that's about to break, you know. Again, if something could go wrong, it will go wrong. And that's my main thing is, yeah, it's a lovely life's vision, but at least on, but on films, it was kind of necessary to make sure that we had our ducks lined up to support anything that was going to be done that day and be prepared for what's happening tomorrow and 2 weeks down the line. So we were always busy. Our lighting process, McGaffer, Len, and I watched Jim, you know, work on the stage before we even went to Wellington. And, you know, he could turn around and he could say, make this taller, this lower, move this over here. And there's a what they call the brain bank, three rows of people at computers who could do that. And we said, okay, let's come up with a kind of a system where we can make changes on the fly. And that brought us to working a lot, as much as we could, with moving lights, the same kind of things you'd see on music videos, yeah. Or, you know, and they've evolved so much that we found out that we would, and with a great programmer, we had two great programmers, we could come up with basically a kind of a Swiss Army knife, at least subset of lighting that we could do so much from the grid and successfully service a lot of different kinds of looks. So you say, okay, here's a backlit scene. Well, that's easy. We know that. And then we put in this Kukulorus inside. I mean, this combination of things through in front of the light that's already built into the light. And now it looks a little bit more like a forest canopy and stuff like that.
Yeah, because you got to, you're like doing stuff that's like in high tech spaces, like spaceships and on the planet, you know, buildings made by people. And then a lot of it's just like out in the wilderness or out in water. And so, you know, and you have to mix and you have to be able to pull those off. Like, and you do. I mean, to me, this is one of the magic tricks of this movie is that, like, again, when you're watching it, you don't doubt it when you see that shot that you described earlier of Jake Sully holding Spider. You don't question it. It just looks real. And I'm thinking about all the levels of technology that went into making that happen.
Also, sometimes it's the micro clues. Okay, you have a scene where the Ash are using flaming arrows and they're shooting by somebody's head or Spider's head. So again, if that flaming arrow went by and didn't do anything on his face as it went by, you know, it wouldn't look right. So we would have, I think in those situations, like we had, you know, it's kind of like Las Vegas. You have several tube lights laid out in a long row, like the kind of like the flight path of the arrow. And then you program that to go a golden glow. Arrow fast right by the person's head. So, you know, it's those little things or what comes off, you know, somebody's firing a machine gun and there's a human being near the machine gun. So sometimes it just gets into the weeds of the minutia of what you have to replicate.
But you made a rig that was able to kind of, you were able to come up with that stuff, you know?
Yeah. And it was, you know, they couldn't have done this. You know, because between the first Avatar and the second Avatar, there was a revolution in lighting in terms of what LED lighting can do, how lights could be programmed, and that's what allowed us to kind of basically make a remote control lighting system. So we would take the same light and we would take one, two, or three lights and bounce them into a huge white surface, and it'd come back as a beautiful soft light from the side. So it was just as much of that as we could do and just stay out of the way of the actors, actors. We did.
Wow. That's just, it's like, I've watched a bunch of behind the scenes and it's hard to imagine it, you know, outside of, out of seeing how you guys did it, because it's, you know, as much as the behind the scenes as you can find online, which is actually harder now because there's a bunch of AI fake slop of that's like.
I know that drives me crazy because in some ways you go, oh my God, this is really inventive. This is really good.
Yeah.
And hating it at the same time.
Yeah.
I'm not fond of that stuff though. I admire the energy that went into it. Yeah.
So one thing that I'm constantly thinking about while I'm watching this kind of technology is like, is there a version of this that boils down to more, you know, kind of workaday movies or TV shows? Like, is there a way that, you know, I don't know, on, you know, Vince Gilligan's Pluribus or something, they can incorporate performance capture like this.
I'm positive there will be a version that's not nearly as complex. But even now, even with virtual reality screens and, you know, these huge screens that are being incorporated into everything, I mean, you know, even a car process scenes, yeah, where you, the background is LED, even that stuff is still a bit of a rough technical go. I mean, there have to be a lot of cooks in the kitchen to make that stuff work the way it should. So, but we'll see it more. Will there be a version of this? I'm sure. Will there be a version of, say, the simulcam technology that was for Avatar 2 and 3 seemed very sophisticated? You bet. You know, the scary thing for me is, like, I don't know if it's scary, but it's moving so fast, whereas a cinematographer can become conversant and agile and expert in one thing, and then 3 years later, that's so old school, you know?
Yeah.
So it's not like we're embedded in a film technology where things stayed. This film stocks got better, lenses got better, but the technology was pretty much the same for decades. And now, you know, it's a matter of months, you know, before that. Yeah.
Well, yeah. I've talked to a bunch of DPs now who are using Unreal Engine basically to make their own previs. And Unreal Engine is kind of like the, you know, very, it's the basic version of what you're doing. You know, it's a virtual world in which, you know, like, some of them are using it to plan lighting plots that they're going to do, you know, months later.
And because Unreal Engine has gotten so good now, especially with lighting and radiosity, like it's going to supersede the technology that we were using to light Avatar 2 and Avatar 3.
Oh, you think?
Oh, totally. In fact, somebody showed me, yeah, come look at this. And this guy, who was an expert at this, he gave me a little preview of how you could light with the Unreal Engine and how you didn't have to do certain things that were kind of labor intensive, like, because radiosity and things like that are what it bounces off, either a smooth surface or an uneven surface or a curved surface.
Yeah.
Looks like we didn't have that. I mean, if I had light coming down through the canopy of the forest and it hits a hot spot of green plants and you want to show that green light bounces off the plant, and if somebody runs by it, you see that light bounce on them, you have to put another light in there. Even though it's an invisible light, it just becomes, this will save a lot of time. But, you know, I'm going, okay, there's another, okay, they're going to previs with Unreal Engine. I mean, but I can't imagine doing that on too low budget. I mean, first the learning curve of learning.
Well, that's the learning curve is the tough part, but it's free. So, you know, you can learn it in your,
yeah,
in your
downtime. which is amazing. Yeah. But then you have to build, or somebody has to build your set if you're lighting a set. I mean, don't they?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, art departments probably build so much. They previs their sets before they build them anyway. So I guess you've got that asset available. And,
you know, probably the generation of filmmakers who are in film school now, like, they grew up with Unreal Engine. It'll just be something that it's always a thing that they know, like, After Effects is to somebody else.
I guess what's amazing is just seeing this exponential curve in terms of technology and this computer technology that people are embracing, you know. And what I just, in terms of style, when digital cameras kind of got to a point where people could start actually filming serious stuff on them, I thought, well, Oh my God. Well, the filmmakers aren't going to coming up aren't going to have that sense of learning exposure and stuff like we had to learn our scales in terms of exposing film. And yet now I just look at stuff streaming and I'm going, people are just doing effing amazing stuff with underexposure. They're doing things that are amazing. And thank God they have the ability to see what they're doing with exposure. It's really daring stuff, and I'm just, you know, really appreciative of what cinematographers, especially in the streaming world, are doing now. So it's amazing.
So something I always want to ask everyone, because I feel like I'm probably asking the most hacky, obvious questions. But I mean, I feel like with Avatar: Fire and Ash, this might be a giant can of worms of a question to ask. But like, what is a story or a shot or an accomplishment that you made in the process of making this film that maybe people haven't asked you about, but something that you think is especially like when you see it on the screen, you're like, holy crap, I can't believe we pulled that off.
You know, my nightmare, you know, was that whatever I did, it wasn't going to match as well as it should or look as good as it should. And what I meant is, which means looks like there wasn't a cinematographer there. We constantly had to come up with solutions that looked right, like, I don't know how much of this was in the movie, but spiders on the back of whatever those flying animals are, Jake, and they're going through clouds and stuff like that. Okay, today we need to make a light that looks like it's hard light, and then all of a sudden it's soft light, and it's moving, and my team was, you know, amazing, and that. Just overall, just feeling like we were part of the movie that enhanced the movie rather than distracted from it. And that's it. That's
it's just an amazing accomplishment. Are you looking forward to getting back to shooting in sweaty small rooms with actors, or are you?
Well, I did a little. Oh no, it's so funny because I did. I was kind of out of it for a while because COVID. My wife wasn't feeling well, then COVID hit, and then big time. And then we decided to move to Bali, and all of a sudden I looked up and I go, oh my God, I've done little things, but I haven't done a feature film in 4 years. And I was feeling like, what's it like to get back up on the horse? So I did a little film in the Philippines, a rom-com, and I really enjoyed that. And it was that experience of that same lovely energy of being on a film where you have, you know, your crew around you, you have your actors, you have interaction with the director on a daily basis that's about solving the issue at hand rather than having to refer to source material that was done, you know, 5 years ago or something, or 3 years ago.
Yeah.
So that was really enjoyable.
That's great, man. Well, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, and your work is always, inspirational and amazing and pushing the boundaries of what people can do. No, I mean,
thank you. Cause you keep the flame alive. I mean, to me, it's like it's amazing that people can say so-and-so, he's talking to so-and-so, and I want to learn about this. And there it is, you know, we make that available.
No, I mean, that's why we do it. Thank you. And we'll have you on anytime you want to come on, sir. So we really appreciate having you on. So thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks so much. Bye.
All right, so that was Russell Carpenter. Thanks a million, Russell. It's always great to have you on here. And congratulations on moving, was it to Indonesia? Oh my God.
Ben, it's short end time. It's time when we talk about pet obsessions. What's your pet obsession this week?
My pet obsession is actually a new release of Adobe software, Adobe 2026. They just dropped a bunch of new stuff. And if you are into After Effects, It's an amazing overhaul of After Effects, the stuff you can do in After Effects, and in particular in bringing in like 3D assets, being able to light them. They kind of created a bunch of 3D primitives. So that's like cube, sphere, cone, yada, yada. And they also released, if you have an Adobe Creative Cloud subscription, like a massive free library of textures you can bring in, and you can light them and composite them right into After Effects. And it's going to open up a lot of, I think After Effects is seeing the writing on the wall, or Adobe is seeing the writing on the wall and saying like, we have to compete with things like Unreal Engine and Blender, and both of which are free, by the way, I should say, but both of which do like incredible 3D stuff that Adobe has never really been able to do. There were things like Element 3D from Video Copilot that would give you the ability to bring in 3D elements and do cool stuff. But this is just kind of native within the workflow. And I look forward to seeing some pretty insane stuff coming out of that. With Premiere, the biggest innovation is kind of a one-click object mask, which, you know, Final Cut Pro X has their version of this, and DaVinci Resolve has their version of it. But it's like, if I had this shot of you, I could just click on you and it would roto you out. And so it's helpful in terms of like, yeah, if I need to composite you, I mean, like the thing that you're going to see a lot of people standing in front of text. You're going to see like a lot of like a text introduction that's like behind someone's head with some kind of funky reveal, because it makes that almost instantaneous. But also for color correction, like if I needed to isolate you and just warm you up a little bit, I could throw you on your own layer and change your color correction just a little bit. And there's so much you can do. They changed the way all the masks operate within Premiere. And it's just cool to see them innovating. And I mean, it literally dropped last week. Now I'm editing another project and I started it in the new Premiere, and it's pretty smooth for a 0.0 release, but I'll probably be experimenting with object masking and some of the other stuff that it's enabled us to do. So if you have an Adobe subscription and you haven't heard about this, certainly by all means, check it out, and it'll give you some new functionalities for whatever you're cutting. And you can quote me on that. How about you, Ilya? What's your pet obsession this week?
I keep being told, and I've been told for years, granted, many years now, that I need to watch The Handmaid's Tale. I have never seen an episode of The Handmaid's Tale, like ever. Mm. And people tell me how great it is. That was like one of the most incredible shows ever made for television.
It is pretty great.
I was staying with a friend the other night, and basically I got lambasted for never having seen the show and never having tried to see the show. There's a sequel to The Handmaid's Tale that debuts on April 8th on Hulu called The Testament. And I also based on the Margaret Atwood book. I have to figure out how between now, which is end of January, and April, I watch 63 episodes of The Handmaid's Tale, and I don't think I can do that.
Just watch the last episode and you'll see the whole recap.
Really? Okay. I just watch the very last episode just of The Handmaid's Tale. And then I'll get 62 episodes of recap, and
I mean, well enough, and I can just. I didn't see all of it. I saw, I think, the first two seasons.
I never saw the show. It's not that I didn't want to see the show, but like, some of our viewers and listeners might be able to relate that in a household where you share television, you know, ownership with another person, if they start watching a show and you don't ever catch up, you're kind of like you're out of the loop. My wife powered through it. She watched all of it. She even went back and started rewatching it with my daughter, and I wasn't around for that. So I missed that. So now I have to, on my own, figure out how I cannot be left out of this loop. I don't know when I'm going to sleep or how I'm going to do it, but I feel like I got to watch probably more than just the last episode and the recap. So
yeah, these are the laments of peak TV when there were like 500 must-see shows and we all kind of lost track of them, as opposed to now when, yeah, there's like, yeah, it's kind of shockingly different than it was like 5 years ago, even.
I agree completely. So anyway, that's sort of my slightly lame short end of this week. All right, Ben, I think that just about does it for this episode. Where can people find you if they want to track you down?
You can find me at benrock.com. Also, you can find me at Kickstarter for The Ultimate Breakup, the short film that I'm set to direct here in a few months. But we made our goal, so no pressure on anyone, but check it out. And if you feel like we added a stretch goal of I'll watch The Blair Witch Project with some lucky people on Zoom and do a live commentary, the whole thing. Check it out. I'm just excited that we're going to get to make a short film. How about yourself, Ilya? Where can people find you?
This week, Hot Rod Cameras in Los Angeles, hotrodcameras.com. If you want to reach out to me through the website by purchasing equipment, or you can find me on the Instagrams and the LinkedIns. That's where most people want to send me an email, it seems like. That's, I'm the only Ilya Friedman out there on, I think, both. So yeah, that you'll find me.
Cool. Well, that about does it then. Who do we need to thank?
Let's thank Alana Cody, our Predator, who is producing and editing all these episodes. Let's thank Kay Zalatracci, who is making all of the music that you heard in this show.
Excellent. Would you like to take us out?
Thanks for tuning in.
All right.
This has been CinePod, the cinematography podcast presented by Hot Rod Cameras. Find your next camera, lens, or accessory at hotrodcameras.com. Watch and subscribe to our show on YouTube or listen on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Follow and interact with us on Instagram, Threads, Facebook, Blue Sky, and LinkedIn. But not X. Don't do that. Thanks for tuning in.